From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Macomb County exec Mark Hackle leading the fight to bring a new fighter jet to Selfridge Air National Guard Base.
His pitch is that we have the infrastructure here, we have the talent here, we have the skill set here.
Healthcare providers watch and wait as Senate Republicans try again to come up with a healthcare bill.
We don't think the Affordable Care Act was perfect. Let's work on repairing those things that weren't working. Let's not throw the whole thing away and start again.
The long journey from drug dealer to anti-drug crusader.
I've been shot 9 times, stabbed twice, jaw broke twice, hammer, pistol, boot, brick here, brick there, 3 bullets still in me.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Returning from the 4th of July recess, Senate Republicans are going to try again to come up with a health care bill that could win the 50 votes it needs to pass. Word is they hope to have a revised bill by week's end, perhaps by Thursday. A Congressional Budget Office score could come by next Monday with a Senate vote by the end of next week. How is all this uncertainty affecting Michigan hospitals and healthcare providers, the ones with many thousands of newly insured patients? We turn to Mary Zatina, Senior Vice President of Governmental Relations and Community Affairs for the Beaumont Health System. They have 8 hospitals throughout Southeast Michigan. Mary Zatina, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and talking about this really important topic.
Let's start broadly, Mary. How did the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, impact Beaumont?
Well, it brought a lot of change at a very rapid pace. Initially, the American Hospital Association said, we know you're going to need more money from us in order to cover more people. So we agreed early on, even before passage of the Affordable Care Act, to a lot of hospital reductions. And since 2010, nationally, that's really totaled about $150 billion. So giving back that money said that hospitals would be willing to put more of our pay at risk and be paid for quality outcomes rather than what we might call piecework, how many of a certain procedure we did. So that prompted us to change our thinking about what we do. And then we also began to see different kinds of conditions showing up in our physician offices, in our emergency departments, when people finally got the confidence to come in. And the confidence to come in and see our healthcare professionals came from finally having an insurance card in their pocket. So the people who came to us were perhaps coming to see a physician or a nurse after many years without. And we saw more advanced cases of disease than we ever like to see. We saw chronic conditions like diabetes that weren't being managed.
How about profit margins and costs? How did the ACA affect those for Beaumont?
Well, you know, people say Medicaid doesn't pay well. Well, it really doesn't cover all of our costs, but the contrast from people who are totally uninsured, who pay nothing, to getting something for that has helped our profit margins. Now, we are a nonprofit healthcare system. Most of the hospitals in Michigan are. And when you're a nonprofit healthcare system and you talk about having excess revenue over expenses, that gives us the precious pennies we need on the dollar to reinvest in new technologies. Beaumont is about to bring online a very sophisticated cancer treatment modality. Those capital costs are all borne by having a stronger financial situation and a stronger balance sheet, which certainly on balance, we have had.
One of the things, Mary, I think that is often kind of lost in this big raging national health care debate, and that is jobs. Has Beaumont found itself hiring or laying off workers over the last 6-plus years that the ACA has been in effect?
Well, Beaumont is definitely growing. We're seeing an increase in the number of people who are coming to us. We have recently enjoyed the coming together of three great hospital systems into one. Oakwood, Botsford, and Beaumont Health System became what we now call Beaumont Health. So sometimes in a merger like that, people expect to see a loss of jobs. The truth is we are larger now than the three legacy organizations were when they were on their own. We have found the uncertainty of the future of health policy, whether it's the American Health Care Act or now what's called the Better Care Reconciliation Act, they both create a lot of uncertainty for our industry. We are trying to focus on two things, improving our quality and cutting our costs, and doing so with a close attention to patients and their families, and to really live and bring to life the compassion that is so important to our mission and the way we want to conduct ourselves. So if you keep focusing on how do I deliver better value, how do I get the quality up and the cost down, we feel it's our best strategy in these uncertain times, you know, no matter what happens to us with health policy legislation. So that's what we've been doing.
As all the debate has been going on in Congress and with the Republican push to repeal and replace or repeal who knows what and then come up with something new, we don't know where it's going. What concerns you the most about that dialogue?
What concerns me the most is that we're not speaking from a place of knowledge of what's in the Affordable Care Act. A lot of folks have finally read the fine print, if you will, of the Affordable Care Act much more closely and are understanding the interweaving of elements of the Affordable Care Act. You know, people rail against the individual mandate. Well, if you don't have a lot of people participating, then of course the sicker, more costly people are going to place a financial burden on insurers, and they don't have the other folks to kind of balance it out. So we're better understanding it. And what I wish for is that we really could introduce the other R word, repair, and focus on what about the Affordable Care Act needs repairing, and let's all work together to set about the task of doing that. We don't think the Affordable Care Act was perfect. Let's work on repairing those things that weren't working for this delicate balance of patient, provider, which would be the hospitals and physicians, and the insurance companies. Let's not throw the whole thing away and start again.
What are the biggest things in the Affordable Care Act that you believe needed to be fixed?
Well, something, you know, you hear about shoring up insurance markets. So something to help this balancing that needs to happen between the high cost customers and others who are opting out or choosing not to get it. We would like to see more addressed about the rising cost of pharmaceutical care. We really are focused on getting costs down. Pharmaceuticals seem to be this huge, out-of-control cost spike in our business that presents a category of cost we really can't seem to manage as well as we would like to. We'd like to see our physicians have more flexibility to work in teams and to work in under kind of incentive situations that don't come and bump up against what we refer to as Stark laws or anti-kickback laws. But we want to incentivize our physicians for doing the right things. There's still some barriers to that because of legislation that we hope to see changed in the coming year. So there are things we can work on together to fix, but throwing the whole thing out is too drastic for these times.
And if that happens, if it does come down to, we even saw President Trump tweeting, if we can't come up to something, then repeal it, and then we'll replace it later. Let's just say that happens, that they do manage to repeal the Affordable Care Act. how do you think that would affect the people that your hospitals serve?
The honest answer is we really don't know. But I think this it will create a new kind of uncertainty. Would someone who perhaps walked into a physician office for the first time in a couple years and finally fessed up that they've had a chronic cough that they can't shake, and now they're coughing up blood, and then, oh my gosh, after all these years of not seeing a clinician, we're discovering maybe that it's lung cancer. And are we treating that person in a course of treatment for that lung cancer? And now where their insurance is at risk of going away, do they stop that care? Or, you know, how sudden will it be? Some of the policies that are coming out sort of extend the time period before the Medicaid expansion goes away. The Senate bill does. It extends the time for the phase down. But then when you do phase down, the cliff that we fall off as a Medicaid community is much steeper than it was before. So what does that cancer patient do? Do they stop their care? Do they put all their savings or their retirement income toward continuing it? Or maybe it just creates so much uncertainty we get back to those days where somebody just ignores the symptoms and ignores the signs until someone who loves them so much says, I don't care what it's going to cost. I'm taking you to the ER or whatever. That's not the way we want to live as a society, and it's not the way we want to care for the people we love. So I hope that won't be the case. We have about a million people in Michigan who have benefited from one aspect or another of the Affordable Care Act. That's like 1 in 10 Michiganders have been helped by this. And we know them. They are people with whom we go to church, and they're the people in front of us or behind us at the grocery store checkout line, or maybe they're the person checking our groceries out. I think when it comes right down to it, we care about these people, and we want them to have the comfort of insurance that helps them get the proper health care they need.
Mary Zatina, Senior Vice President of Governmental Relations and Community Affairs for the Beaumont Health System. Mary, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up, how the Yuper dialect changes as you move from Sault Ste. Marie to Ironwood. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is no better reminder of what a diverse state we live in than contemplating the differences between the UP and the Lower Peninsula. A Grand Valley State professor is spending his summer exploring the way Upers talk, crisscrossing the Upper Peninsula to record longtime residents. Will Rankinen is not only a professor at GVSU, he is a born and bred Uper. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So what's the idea behind this summer research project, besides the opportunity to visit some mighty beautiful spots across the Upper Peninsula?
Yes, indeed. It is definitely beautiful up here. I was born and raised in the UP myself, so my passion for the UP is very much grounded in the area. But in terms of why I'm doing research this particular summer is because I've done a significant amount of research in the area, and then other colleagues, a colleague of mine, Catherine Remlinger from Grand Valley State University, has just recently published her book called Uper Talk, and there's starting to develop a particular interest on how the way the speech patterns and trying to understand the speech patterns in the Upper Peninsula. However, we really don't know what exactly is happening across the UP. A lot of people have preconceived notions of what is stereotypically Uper, so to speak, if you want to use that term. Some people have negative feelings about that. Some people have positive feelings about it. But generally speaking, people don't really understand what is the diversity that is found up there. What are the similarities and differences? And that's essentially what I'm really trying to find out. I'm not after what is the right or wrong ways of producing language that is English up there, but I'm interested in looking at the similarities and differences across the UP, not just in one specific area.
So you are recording people? Do you have a script, or are you just conversing with people? Exactly how are you doing this?
Yes, it's a recorded interview, and it's anonymous. What's happening with the interview, it does take about an hour to an hour and a half of people's time. It's completely voluntary, and what's involved is it's a little atypical. It's not the typical Q&A question and answer interview from start to finish. In fact, there is a Q&A at the beginning and at the end of the interview, but this is a language study, so I'm actually getting participants to give me production data. That is, they read a reading passage, read a series of word lists. Then they also have to provide perception data. That is, they will listen to a series of sounds, speech sounds, and they have to decide what they think they hear based on a set of options. Then there are some other tasks that get after beliefs and attitudes about the way they think about their community, but also other areas in which people speak differently.
And I know you've got three regions that you're focusing on, the Michigan-Wisconsin border, the interior, and the Canadian border. What's the significance of those three zones?
Yeah, so, and that's not exhaustive. Obviously, there's this, you know, the central UP where, you know, Escanaba is not included, Manistique, St. Ignace, Munising. There are a number of handful of towns that could have been included in the study, but due to various factors, as well as resources, available resources, these three regions or six locations have been carefully chosen. One of the big reasons why these six were chosen was based on previous research that I personally have done in the Marquette County area. For my dissertation, that was published in 2014, I found that there was something going on, particularly among the Finnish and Italian Americans that I documented in the Marquette County, that showed that there might be Canadian-like influences in that area, particularly among the younger generation. Now, the question was, that based on that research, was that a Canadian influence directly from Canada, or is it just a Canadian-like influence, but that was developing from within the community? So this particular research study is getting after that particular question. Is there a Canadian influence across the entire UP, or is it some sort of change that's happening across the UP in different communities? And so this particular study is really getting after that, looking at the Canadian border, towns nearby the Canadian border, then looking at other potential influences across the Michigan-Wisconsin border, and then looking at more of the interior UP.
Interesting. I'm talking with Grand Valley State University Professor Will Rankin about the study he's doing, research study on how Michiganders talk in the Upper Peninsula. He's spending his summer recording volunteers to get a sense of their speech. Can you help us, Will, since I'm going to call on the fact that you are, as you say, a born and bred Youper, how Michiganders talk? So can you give us a difference between downstate speech and how they would say it in Youper?
Yeah, not a problem. I mean, there are a number of ways of language that we could rely on. Vocabulary is a really good example of this. We'll just start with one, the word S-A-U-N-A. Oftentimes, people downstate will pronounce sauna.
Sauna, yes.
Sauna, yes. Up in the UP, however, historically, in terms of the literature, people have suggested strongly that the only way you can say it up in the UP is sauna.
Sauna. Okay.
Sauna, yeah, ow. It's the ow. That first syllable is really, that first vowel in that syllable is really what you're after. And it's sauna. There's often a little bit of a duration difference there as well. But what we're really getting after is the American pronunciation and the Finnish pronunciation.
Yes.
The Finnish pronunciation is really what is kind of built and sustained within the particular UP. However, with that said, what I've been finding in my meanderings across the UP is that that may not be true, hold true across the entire UP. The UP itself, yes, particularly on the West End, where you have a very strong Finnish population and still a lot of Finnish pride, and you can still hear some Finnish being produced and whatnot, that pronunciation is very strong, the sauna.
But if you were over by the Canadian border, you might get something different.
Categorically, from what I'm hearing among people from the Newberry, that is the Luce County, or in the Sioux area, they will prefer the pronunciation of sauna. Now, what's interesting is that not everybody says sauna. In fact, there are some people that will definitely still produce the Finnish pronunciation. However, many of them will say that, well, I was told that I need to say it that way to pronounce it correctly. So there's this right and wrong sort of pressure that's sort of, if you want to be a Youper, you should say it sauna, not sauna. So there's these sorts of things that are going on, pressures that are from outside of the community and the pressures from within this community.
Well, I know you're still looking for volunteers, and I find it interesting you want the person to be a native English speaker, be a longstanding UP resident, only having spent less than 5 years away from that area, so you don't want them to have been tainted, if you will, and have a high school diploma and no more than a four-year degree and no history of speech or hearing disorder. So if anyone is willing in these areas, you can go to Will's Facebook page or you can email him. And we're going to put his contact address for you on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. And you'll be looking for volunteers throughout you're going through pretty much through the month of July.
Yes, pretty much through the month of July and part of August, beginning part of August.
Will Rankin, an interesting study, and we'll be interested to hear what you find and your conclusions once you kind of digest all of these hours of interviews. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I'm Cynthia Canty, and you are listening to Stateside.
Each morning I get up, I die a little.
And it is time for Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here with more of the professional theater productions from all around the state. And the accent, David, this time seems to be on nice, fan-friendly summertime musicals.
That's right. You know, we get a lot of crowd-pleaser shows in the summer because people want to be late. They want entertainment. They don't want a lot of heavy stuff. So I was out at the Tibbetts Opera House in Coldwater this past weekend to see their production of Damn Yankees. Which is definitely a crowd pleaser. And for the uninitiated, this is a show that debuted in the 1950s when the New York Yankees ruled baseball. And a middle-aged real estate salesman who's a rabid fan of the lowly Washington Senators trades his soul to the devil in order to become a young slugging baseball hero himself who can take his team to the pennant.
This would be fun for summer. And of course, there's the famous number, You've Gotta Have Heart. Let's take a quick listen just to remind everybody. This is from the 1958 film version of Damn Yankees, directed by George Abbott and Stanley Donen.
This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else, something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope. Mustn't sit around and mope. Nothing's half as bad as it may appear. Wait till next year and hope.
A great slugger we haven't got.
A great pitcher we haven't got. A great ball club we haven't got.
What do we got? We've got heart. All you really need is heart.
So this is an oldie but a goodie?
It is. Some people might call it a moldy oldie, which is something I hear a lot out on the road. But you've got the devil. You've got somebody trading soul. But you also have baseball. And that song that is an absolute earworm when you leave the theater, of You Gotta Have Heart.
How's the cast and the production?
It was quite good. It was quite good. The young actor who plays Joe Hardy is quite good.
And we go over now to Marine City, the Riverbank Theater, which is doing?
They're doing Sister Act, which is another big crowd pleaser. This is a musical based on the 1992 film starring Whoopi Goldberg about a nightclub singer who witnesses a murder and is put into safe house custody in secret at a convent. And among other things, the lead character spices up the sisters' choir as well as really their whole existence. And this musical has a lot of great music in it, and it's very light-friendly stuff.
Well, here's a little bit of Raise Your Voice. This comes from the 2011 Tony Awards performance.
God can't hear you.
Yeah, this musical opened in London on the West End in 2009, and music by Alan Menken. So that's pretty darn good pedigree.
Very good credentials on the music.
Yeah. Now we go from Nuns to Queen.
Right. For rock fans, in fact, tonight at the Barn Theater in Augusta, we have Queen, We Will Rock You. And it's a play that utilizes Queen's music, but it's not a biographical story about the band. The show uses Queen's music, which, of course, I think we're all pretty much familiar with at this point. The story takes place in the future where rock music is banned and globalization is complete. And everywhere the kids watch the same movies, wear the same fashions, and think the same thoughts, and individuality is unthinkable. Unless you're a rebel, a bohemian, if you will, if for Queen fans, who lives in the underbelly and resists the sterilized world, the bohemians just need to get a hero to find them. And Galileo is that man in the show. So, and it features Queen's big hits, Play the Game, Somebody to Love, Killer Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, and the title track, too. So, interestingly, the show has not been treated well by critics when it's been in big venues in London and New York. But I will say audiences eat this show up.
You know the music, so that gets it started
right
there.
The music is very popular with everybody.
Here's Somebody to Love from that soundtrack album.
I got no feel, I got no rhythm, I just keep losing my feet.
Sounds like if you saw Moving Out, which is Billy Joel music, that tells the story of the young people of the Vietnam era. Same idea. So don't be looking for a story about the band, but using the band's music to advance this story.
Exactly, exactly.
And finally, something opening this week in Ann Arbor.
That's right. The Penny Seats, right here in Ann Arbor, will open in West Park, which is the entrance of it is on South 7th Street, with Peter and the Starcatcher. And this show is being done a lot. In fact, we mentioned it a few weeks ago with another theater company. It's popular because it's totally accessible by families. It's a prequel to Peter Pan and focuses on how the orphan boy is transformed into Peter Pan. I would not necessarily call the show a musical.
So this is not Finding Neverland.
Right, exactly.
Which
it's
is a,
more of a play with music rather than being a musical. And it should be interesting in the West Park outdoor space, which I've actually performed in before. So I can attest it's a very interesting performance space and great fun. And so that's the Penny Seats Theater Company. And that opens this week on Thursday. Because it's outdoor theater, you might want, and if you're interested, you might want to follow the Penny Seats on Facebook, because they will post a thing on Facebook if the weather is going to will be an issue.
All right. Bring
your lawn chairs. Yeah.
And enjoy a Michigan evening.
Right.
All right. So to recap, we have the Tibbetts Opera House in Coldwater with Damn Yankees, the Riverbank Theater in Marine City doing Sister Act. We have the Barn Theater in West Michigan in Augusta with Queen, We Will Rock You. And wrapping up with Penny Seats Theater Company in Ann Arbor, Peter and the Starcatcher. David Kiley of Encore Michigan, thank you so much. And, of course, just head to EncoreMichigan.com, and you can get details on these and other productions all around Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And now a follow-up for you on the Asian carp threat to Lake Michigan. You may recall a live adult silver carp was caught last month on the wrong side of the electric barriers that are meant to protect Lake Michigan from this invasive fish. The first response was to fish heavily in the Chicago waters around the electric barriers, searching for more Asian carp. The verdict is in. 2 weeks of very intensive fishing and sampling turned up exactly no more Asian carp. But last month's discovery has certainly energized Michigan's congressional delegation to up the pressure on the Trump administration to get it to release a long overdue report on ideas for keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, and also to up the fight to preserve federal spending for the Great Lakes Restoration Project. Its funding was eliminated in the president's proposed budget. Still to come, the long journey from drug dealer to anti-drug crusader.
In 3 years, from the age of 14 and 17, I carried 14 caskets. Family members and friends who had either died from drug overdose, who had committed suicide, or were murdered in the process.
Quite a story. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's strong history in the defense sector dates back to Rosie the Riveter in World War II. And the MEDC reports that defense sector supports 105,000 jobs in our state, turning out $9 billion in goods and services. Well, Michigan wants to continue that tradition by landing the new F-35 fighter jet. Selfridge Air National Guard Base in Macomb County is one of five locations now being considered as a home for the new jet. And today is the day they make their case to the Pentagon. Mara McDonald has been covering this story for Detroit's WDIV-TV. A big meeting today, Mara, in this quest to land the F-35 for Selfridge. Who's there and what's the sales pitch?
Who isn't at this meeting today? What they are doing is having the top tier of the Department of Defense come into Macomb today to assess whether Selfridge is where they want the F-35 to be. It's interesting that Selfridge is the last stop. These people have already been to the other four bases that are under consideration. Selfridge is the last, and I think the feeling in Macomb is it's a good sign that we're last because, you know what they say, saving the best for last.
Interesting. So what's their pitch? What can Michigan say to convince the Pentagon to bring the F-35 to Selfridge?
And I was talking to the Macomb County executive, Mark Tackle, about this yesterday. I told him that they are running so hard to get this that I wouldn't be surprised if they had a full orchestra waiting for the DOD people today, you know, doing the battle hymn of the Republic. They are that into making this happen. They have produced this 60-page glossy magazine, essentially, trying to pitch them on why Macomb is the best. They will tell you, and HAPA will come out and say it, that Michigan is a defense mecca. And he's not really overstating that. We have in this state 4,000 either military installations or defense contractors, and 75% of them are based in Macomb. His pitch is that we have the infrastructure here, we have the talent here, we have the skill set here, so that if you do decide to base these F-35s in Macomb, it will take minimal money, time, and training to make it happen.
If we get the F-35, what would getting that mean for Michigan's economy?
Bottom line, it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity. If we land the F-35s for Selfridge, it means that that base will no longer incessantly be on closure list. You know, it seems like every 3 or 4 years there's a, well, are we going to close Selfridge? And, you know, are we going to fly the A-10 Warthog, which is what Selfridge currently has? The A-10 is still going to be used, but it's not the future. The F-35 is. You land the F-35 here, and Mark Hackle will tell you for the next 30 to 35 years, you have no base closure issues, you have nothing else, and then you have the added benefit of all those jobs supporting those F-35s coming to Macomb. Lockheed Martin produces the F-35. They've already been to Macomb in the last several weeks, and they talked to hand-picked suppliers. These are people that Lockheed wanted to talk to. Not that Mark Hackle wanted them to talk to. They wanted to see if they had the people here that they can swing work to and make stuff happen.
And if the F-35 goes elsewhere, what might that mean for Selfridge? I mean, what kind of economic hit would it mean if that base closes?
Immediately, it's not an economic hit just because the Army and Air Force have said they're going to continue with the Warthog, but not forever. So if the F-35 doesn't come here, they had best try and come up with some other option.
When's the Pentagon expected to deliver this verdict, Mara?
Well, the original hope was this month, but the word that our congressional delegation is getting is likely the second week of August. And they're working extremely hard to make this happen, Cindy. I mean, this is legacy kind of stuff, as Hackle was telling me last night. He said, you know, if we make this happen, it's a legacy thing.
Mara McDonald, WDIV-TV in Detroit. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Mara.
Cindy, thank you so much for having me.
Is there hope for a new life after you're addicted to drugs, selling drugs? Detroiter Sheldon Hill is proof the answer is yes. After years and years of selling and using drugs, multiple arrests, Sheldon Hill went into an addiction recovery program. He was in his 40s, and it worked. Today, his sole mission in life is keeping others from making the mistakes and choices that he made as a young man. Sheldon Hill is a certified peer support specialist and prevention specialist. He works with a number of recovery groups around Southeast Michigan, particularly with the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. And he set up his own community service organization to spread his recovery message even further. Sheldon Hill, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. You have said that growing up, you kind of had two sides. One was Sheldon, a respectful, responsible boy that your mother raised, and the other was Dennis, which is your middle name. So tell us about Dennis. What was Dennis like?
Dennis the Menace.
Remember
in the 60s, the television show, Dennis the Menace, and because my name, middle name is Dennis, I was allowed to get away with a lot, and it created an entitlement issue.
Meaning?
Meaning that I felt I was above the law. Rules didn't apply to me.
And
it didn't. My mom, my grandmother, just leave that boy alone. That's Dennis the Menace. Just leave him alone.
Okay, so Dennis the Menace didn't get those guardrails along the road.
No boundaries. Did not learn boundaries early at all.
Okay. And how did that lead to you using drugs?
My dad was a drug dealer. My dad, at the age of 12 years old, came back into my life. I was having so many issues in school with truancy, fighting, and things of that nature, that when they brought my dad back into my life thinking he would help break this down, he took me with him to a restaurant, and he asked me to go to the store next door to buy a pop. I didn't have any money. So he said, well, that's not going to happen again. Gave me a $100 bill, and he said, later I'll tell you what we can do about this. He takes me back to his home, hands me a pound of weed, and a pistol, and said, this is how you get your money. Show me how to break it down, and I began dealing drugs for my dad at the age of 12 years old.
So you were dealing before you were using?
At the age of 12, yeah. I knew.
When'd you start using?
During the process of dealing, because, we would try the product and make sure it was good, and we were drinking, and it just went on from that point. I left high school with $300,000 cash. 150 pounds of weed still left to sell, and I'm dating my French teacher. So I've always, been...
You lived old. You
fast.
Lived old, and you lived hard and fast.
Fast. In 3 years, from the age of 14 and 17, I carried 14 caskets. Family members and friends who had either died from drug overdose, who had committed suicide, or were murdered in the process. The first person I seen murdered, my dad blew him out of a window because he stole some tools from us. So the issues that were traumatizing, I never identified them as trauma.
And it never dawned on you that you were an addict?
No. The lifestyle, my first book's entitled Dealers Are Addicts Too, Street Life, the Addiction.
And the toll it took on you personally, how many times were you shot?
I've been shot 9 times. 3 times, first time, 6 times, the second time. But I had become desensitized.
That's and arrest didn't stop you either.
No, this is what we're talking about. 77 bookings was as an adult. My first arrest, I was 12 years old. A police officer stopped me, and I started walking away, and he turned me back around and tore my shirt. I spent good money for that shirt, so I slapped him. I had no respect for the law. We were just above the law. My dad had friends, and they all looked at me as little Arnold, little man. My mom, with my dad being gone, and I'm providing for the household. Miss Hill, here comes your husband. They're calling me, and I'm Big D, and I had all of these different titles. And so the issue of entitlement was not, it was to be expected.
Did you ever have a point where, when this was all going on, where you were like, I need to get off this merry-go-round? Or did it just feel like, well, this is how people live?
It was how my dad lived. Mm-hmm. And my dad was my role model. I wanted him to be in my life, so I did what he did. But also, I built bridges for the state of Michigan and Army Corps of Engineers.
You had a job.
I kept jobs.
Yeah.
I never not worked, but I always had a hustle. And that was what we were taught. You always keep a hustle. So as area manager for Church of Fried Chicken, I'm running 5 restaurants, but I'm selling cocaine out the drive-through window.
Ultimately, what kinds of drugs did you wind up using?
Everything we sold. We went from TAC, mescaline. We smoked a lot of weed, hashish, angel dust, powder cocaine, and then went to crack cocaine, and crack cocaine eliminated everything else. Crack cocaine is very selfish, greedy, drug. It wants you to have no other. It's possessive.
What changed for you?
A so-called friend was actively using cocaine, freebasing, and he didn't want to stop. What I find out later from some of the young ladies he was with, that because he didn't want to stop and he knew I had cocaine to sell, he called for me to come join them. I get there. He throws a rock into the pipe. The smoke swirls around in his glass bowl, and I'm mesmerized. It's like the genie in a bottle. I'm like, whoa. And then he hands it to me, and he puts one in for me. It was 2 days later. $24,000 worth of cocaine that I had powder had been cooked up and smoked. I hadn't been to work in 2 days, and I'm the executive senior store manager for the restaurant. And it dawned on me, like, what just happened? Now I'm addicted. I can't stop. I have a dealer's habit where, I mean, it's costing me $12,000 a week in just cocaine.
So I want to know how it is you're here, healthy, sober, not using. What was the turning point and what made the difference to get you off this merry-go-round of drugs?
In the first place, I was doing it wrong. Mm. I don't like to smoke, so I wasn't inhaling it in my lungs. I was swallowing it into my stomach. So when I went for mental health services, and that's another thing that has to be addressed, my mental health needs. So it was necessary for me to accept the diagnosis, take medication to stabilize, then focus on regaining a healthy foundation, starting a new life. But because I had been swallowing the smoke instead of inhaling it in my lungs, it didn't take the same effects on me, health-wise or whatnot. I'm 58 years old. I'll be 59 this year. I've been shot 9 times, stabbed twice, jaw broke twice, hammer, pistol, boot, brick here, brick there, 3 bullets still in me. It's amazing.
What treatment stopped this for you and got you clean?
It wasn't treatment. It was a judge. Mm-hmm. I went in front of the judge for the very last time 14 years ago, and he asked a question. He said, "Mr. Hill." I said, "Yes, Your Honor." He said, "Do you know you've been booked 77 times?" And I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but there was a lady in the background. She said, "Damn," just like that. And I was like, oh, I did. I was embarrassed.
That voice hit you. That voice got you. That her gut reaction.
I was embarrassed. I wasn't angry. I was embarrassed. And I said, "No, Your Honor." He said, "But I'm going to do this favor you asking me." And I did not know what he was talking about. But they have what they call a pre-sentence evaluation. And so I asked for drug treatment again for the 10th time. He said, "I'm going to do that favor you asking me. I'm going to give you drug treatment." He said, "But I promise you this much. If you ever come back in front of my courtroom again, you will go to the penitentiary." Now, mind you, I'm facing 4 charges. Conspiracy to interstate transport narcotics over 9 state lines, interstate transportation of stolen property over 9 state lines.
That's some serious
credit
time.
Card fraud and criminal racketeering. Yeah. 175 months federal time, 7.5 to 15 state time. He said 6 months in the county jail. Whew. And when he hit the gavel, I took off. The guard pulled his gun. He didn't. I was like, "Where are you going?" I stepped away, reaching for the door handle to go back to the bullpen. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "It's over, Your Honor. You will never see me again. I'm talking to the judge. I promise you, you will never see me again." And they took me into the back. And within 30 days, I was in a rehab program in the jail. And I ended up starting a program in the jail called the Missing Dads Program. I went immediately to work. And I started to mentor. I'm constantly reaching out to young men as I built my network of dealers behind me. I figure if they follow me in, maybe they'll follow me out. And I begin to share. And because I realized that 19 young men in that system, dads were missing in their lives, and that, or if they were with their dads, they used with their dads, that was the problem. We had to go home. We had to begin to take care of our families.
So everything clicked in at last 14 years ago, and now you work to keep others. This is your mission. What do you say to young people who are a lot like you were when you were, you know, running around at 14 doing things that people never do in a lifetime? What do you tell them? What lessons did you learn through your years of addiction and now recovery?
You can't win. First of all, you can't win. It costs, the costs are astronomical. And the system is not designed for you to be successful this way. But you can be successful. Like for myself, as Church's Fried Chicken, I was a training store manager. Mm-hmm. So I trained now on entrepreneurship. It's a piece called Inner City Executives. So I help them write business plans and design a life that they can be successful without dealing and selling drugs. So, like, I'm the hope man, not the dope man now. Mm. I sell hope, not dope.
I want to talk about ways that family members can keep the kids away from the drug culture at the first place. Well, I mean, what do you tell parents and family members? What can they or should they be doing?
Looking out for the family member that is there causing the problem. My father was my problem. There are other family members that we have access to that aren't healthy, and we have to be kept away from them. They should be protecting us, but they're not. They're actually hurting us, and it's not fair.
Sheldon, what do you tell kids? What do you tell those teens who think that, oh, you're an old guy, you don't know anything? They know it all when they're teens, don't they?
They think they do.
They think they do. That's right. How do you crack that?
I just, transparency. I'm very honest with them about my suffering. They see me and they tell their friends, that's Mr. Hill. He came to our school and he used to smoke crack. And he told us about that. Who does not know someone that has some sort of addiction and has a shame of it? The stigma, the shame in it, and it's supposed to be kept secret, can no longer be kept secret. It should not be kept a secret. If it's an addiction in the family, if someone's suffering, don't say they're just sick. Tell them what's going on. They already know.
Do you ever struggle to stay drug-free? I mean, do you ever feel like, okay, I've got this. I don't have to work at my recovery anymore. I'm good. Or is there that voice still calling you back at times?
Oh, I still make meetings on a regular basis. I'm activities chairperson for Narcotics Anonymous. I handle all of these sober events for the West area of Detroit. It's a must. I mean, there's never not a liquor store with a light flashing when it gets dark. There's not, they just found out there were 285 unlicensed marijuana distribution centers in this city of Detroit, and they've shut down and still have 55 to go. It's big money. Drug sales are big business for somebody. It's never going away. So what I do is stay in touch. I mean, my daughters, my mom, friends in the fellowship, I stay in touch. So we have a whole culture of individuals that make meetings 30 years down the road, still making meetings.
And keeping an eye on each other.
We have to keep an eye on each other. We have to have it. It's not going anywhere.
Sheldon Hill is a state-certified peer support specialist and prevention specialist working for many recovery organizations, including the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, and runs his own community service organization. Sheldon, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Petulano Ali, and Claire Bryan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.